Hi, folks. Happy 2017. Welcome to our first episode of This Week in Law for the year. Emery Roan is back. Our good friend Jack Lerner is back. Mike's on vacation, but that's okay. We're going to talk about pantsuits and licenses, the Axinar case heading to trial, and is there a good kind of ransomware? All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 372, recorded January 6th, 2017. Santa Fair. Happy New Year. Happy 2017. Welcome to the first episode of This Week in Law for the new year. I am here with co-host Emery Roan, who is busy getting a fabulous legal education at California Western School of Law these days, and busy getting back from wonderful holiday world travel. Great to see you again, Emery.
Denise, it is a pleasure to be back. I am so excited to start the new year off right, so let's get into it.
Let's get into it. We have one of our very favorite guests on the show joining us again. We were just talking before starting the show that we've been remiss in having Jack on more frequently, but we're addressing that issue right here, right now, having him on today. Jack Lerner from UC Irvine, where he is a clinical professor of law and the head of the UCI Intellectual Property Arts and Technology Clinic. Hello, Jack. Great to see you again.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you back on the show. I am told I am supposed to mention corned beef to you from Jim Tyre. So
yes,
corned
Jim
beef.
Tyre and I have been to Langer's to eat corned beef, the greatest corned beef sandwich in the world, and that includes east of the Mississippi as well as west of Mississippi. So big shout out to Langer's, and we're going to have to get some corned beef again.
Wonderful. Is there
a pastrami, but.
Jack and I are basically in each other's backyards here because I'm also in Orange County, California. Is Langer's nearby? I somehow have missed it if it is.
Langer's is in very close to downtown Los Angeles, where I lived for many years and taught for many years. So it remains close to my heart, put it that way.
Yes.
I can't believe we're starting this show off talking about Langer's. Shout out to Langer's, everybody. It is the best.
Starting the year off talking about Langer's.
That's right.
We've got
all downhill from here, in other words.
That's right. And now I'm getting hungry too. Let's break for our nutrition break if necessary and dive right into talking about interesting developments while we were gone over break. I hope people caught our best of episode last time around over the holidays. That's episode 371 if you missed it. But right now we're going to start making some memorable moments for 2017 and begin our discussion of legal issues for the year with one of our favorite topics, the Axinar film. So there was an extraordinarily big development again while we were gone over break. The parties in the Axinar dispute, which if you are not familiar with, I can set the stage a bit. There is a very high quality, high production value fan film being made out of the CBS Paramount universe, but in the Star Trek universe. It is called Axinar. It does not exist as a film yet, which I think is an interesting thing to note as we continue to discuss the legal decisions being made about the film that doesn't exist yet. What does exist is a script, a very well done trailer. I believe they've released, and I haven't seen it yet, so I'm going to have to catch up after the show, a scene that will be from the film if it gets made. And what also exists is a lawsuit. And the lawsuit has been going on for some time by Paramount and CBS against the folks making Axinar, trying to prevent them from being able to make the film. We've talked about that a lot on the show. So the most recent developments in that suit are the court just ruled on the parties' cross motions for summary judgment. Each party came in and said, we should win the case. court, and you should decide that in our favor right now. Neither party won completely. The case will go to trial. And from the documents I've seen, the trial date is right now set for January 31st, 2017. Those can be fluid, and I wouldn't be surprised if that moved, but that's what's on the pretrial documents right now. In Los Angeles, before Judge Klausner in the Central District of the Central District of California, Federal District Court. So in the cross motions for summary judgment, neither party won, but CBS and Paramount got some very important rulings in their favor. Jack, you want to bring us up to speed as to what exactly we're going into trial with here?
Well, just this week, the court ruled that essentially this had to go to trial. And, you know, the court ruled on a number of issues. I'm just pulling up the opinion here. The court ruled on a number of issues. The most, I think, notable is that this form of fan fiction is not fair use. Now, it's not to say that not all fan fiction is not fair use, but here the court said, look, this isn't fair use. It's a classic prequel. A lot of, you know, money was raised, and most importantly, this is the kind of thing exactly that Paramount would want to actually do, is do a Star Trek prequel. And so, you know, essentially that's what the court says, that the court can go to trial, and there the jury has to decide a number of things. They'll probably also be given the fair use jury instructions, but also they need to decide a key issue in copyright, which is substantial similarity. That probably won't be that difficult. I think that this will probably settle at some point. But we'll see what happens, and it could actually be an injunction as well, which I think is pretty interesting for a variety of reasons as well. We could get into.
Right, Emery, I know you've read through the ruling as well. What jumped out at you?
Yeah, so actually a couple things I thought were pretty interesting. The ruling is definitely worth a read. If nothing else, it gives a lot of clarity, I think, into some of the points that Judge Klausner weighed more heavily than others. So to just provide a little bit of background, the film that we're talking about is called Axanar, and it is ostensibly about, according to the defendants, a minor character from the original series that had his story expanded into their own quote-unquote original story. Now, the Klausner really pushed back, I think, against this idea that the original character, the protagonist, was a quote-unquote minor character. Even though the character was only used once in the original series in a single episode, according to the opinion sort of brings up over and over again that, in the mythos of the story, of the way that the character was originally used, the character is famous in the Star Trek universe. This is Garth of Iznar, who apparently his exploits were required reading by all of Starfleet Academy. He also was the protagonist in a actual fictional book that was released under Paramount's copyright. And so it seemed to be really important to Judge Klausner that the characters that were being infringed were not minor at all, that they had a sort of established character, that there was no doubt, at least to the copyrightability of the individual character, Garth of Iznar. They also brought up points that said that the film in question is dealing with stories on planets that were also notable characters in the original series. Axanar, Klingons, Vulcans, according to Klausner, these are all individually copyrightable components. And so that's, I think, really interesting because of what it implies for the fan art industry at large. This means that it's sort of implied almost in his ruling that, you know, if this was a wholly original character set in the Star Trek universe, if this was a wholly original world set in the Star Trek universe, it might be a different story, but that's not the case here. Now, of course, in fan fiction and in fan art in general, there are certainly examples where they're just taking the universe, but a lot of times it's about, you know, writing the characters or using characters that people already know or expanding on universe or aspects of the universe that people already appreciate and want more of. Another thing that I think really was interesting here is the way that the defendants, I think, shot themselves in the foot. So a lot of weight was given to the fact that this was very successful commercial project that had raised, you know, millions of dollars on Kickstarter. And that I'm trying to find the line right here, but essentially the defendant had acknowledged that what they were trying to do was to quote, not directly quote, sorry, paraphrasing, he's saying is that he wants to give fans a new way of consuming this, you know, Star Trek content, which of course, that's exactly the fourth factor in the fair use analysis is, you know, how likely is this to negatively affect the market for the original work? In a way, the defendants made the argument for the prosecution that, yeah, they are directly trying to create something that could be a free substitute to the paid works that Paramount owns. So, you know, notes for anyone that wants to argue fair use for their fan work in the future. But that being said, you know, it is not a good picture for fan art. You know, if I find it hard to imagine ways in which fan fiction or fan art would be not infringing if this opinion holds. So I think there's some interesting points to be gathered from this.
Well, and I think this raises – sorry, go ahead, Denise.
I was just going to say we've talked before in the context of discussing this film – of the importance, not just of the money, but of the technology that is available to people who are not, you know, I was going to say not within the studio system. And I don't know if that's an accurate statement to say about the people making Axanar. As I understand it, some of them, you know, have great experience working for other studios and you know, are definitely Hollywood technical professionals. But the technology that is available to them in their independent capacity, yes, they've raised money, but they are not, you know, affiliated with CBS or Paramount here or any other major studio. They're doing this on their own. And the fact that they can put forward a product that, as Emery was saying, is good enough to let them out of that fourth factor of the fair use analysis, that it can actually compete with something that CBS and Paramount could produce themselves, I think is playing an important role in the court's overall analysis here of whether fair use should apply. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that as technology improves, perhaps we need to think about whether fair use is, you know, what it's intended to do. Should it make a difference that you can make something? Should things have to be fuzzy and blurry and amateur looking in order to qualify for fair use? What do you think about that, Jack?
Okay. So
I think it brings up Section 1201.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, there is a Section 1201 issue that this relates to the issues around around making encryption illegal in the work that documentary filmmakers have done to try to show or making decrypting and circumventing the technological protection measures like encryption that exist on DVDs, why that's so important. And that's because of the ability to remix and the need to comment on and criticize works in culture, right? But this is a little bit different here from fan fiction, where there isn't actually, you know, appropriation, even if lawful, there isn't appropriation of Star Trek in terms of actually saying, okay, we're going to take Star Trek and then put it in our documentary or whatever, or a fictional film, in order to comment on it, right? What you have here is a classic prequel, and it's a prequel that uses an existing character, right? And it uses all kinds of copyrightable elements of this universe. But I want to push back against the idea that this is somehow a declaration about all fan fiction, because I think there's a strong argument, and maybe the doctrine should be stronger in this direction than it is, but I think there's a strong argument that there should be a lot of leeway in the law for fans to create fan fiction. Now, doing $1 million Kickstarter and producing a big production about it is a little different. But putting that aside, I mean, what if this wasn't about Garth of Izar or Iznar? And and I don't know if it's Izar or Iznar, because Emery said Iznar, but the opinion says Izar. So,
Me, it is Iznar.
folks on IRC can chime in, but again, I mean, you know, look, there's a couple things at issue here. First of all, you're dealing with a fantasy world that has become a huge part of culture, a huge part of American culture and culture all over the world, right? People use culture to express themselves. That's something that the law and society should encourage, right? People go on Reddit. If you go on to the subreddits and dealing with Game of Thrones, there are people with theories. They don't have very much fan fiction on there, but there are people with theories that go on for pages and pages, some of the most glorious tinfoil hat theories you could ever imagine. And they're doing this because this work has touched them, and they're spending time thinking about this because their work has touched them, and they want to talk about it, right? Imagining an alternate universe inside the Star Trek universe is really not that much different, right? So imagine if this had said, hey, okay, somebody created a universe where you had Klingons, where you had a United Federation, where you had people, you know, a Captain Kirk or a Captain or the other Captain Picard, who stood for a certain type of person, who stood for a certain set of values that really speaks to me as a creator, and I want to imagine something that took place in that universe, right? That isn't necessarily something that we should just outright outlaw and say that the copyright holder for Star Trek should control every imagining of anything that takes place in that universe forever, right? Because it's a very, very thin line, and I would actually argue a very blurry line, or maybe even an indiscernible line between a straight-up criticism where someone is saying, hey, let's look at Star Trek, let's look at what it's saying about the world, and let's imagine a Star Trek story that takes place. And so, I think that fan fiction is in many respects a form of criticism, and it's a form of someone saying, I'm going to use this cultural expression that's out there or this expression that's out there in our culture to express something about myself and to actually put into words or put into symbols or images my own feelings and my own thoughts and my own perspective on the world, right? And so you can't simply say, all right, well, they created, the Klingons with the bone formations in the forehead, and they created this Federation, blah blah blah, and these captains with various values, and Lieutenant Uhura, and all that other stuff. Therefore, you know, no one else can ever talk about this unless they're explicitly doing it in a tightly cabined kind of, okay, well, I'm going to put this in a book of literary criticism, and I'm going to have to invoke Foucault and Derrida and all this other stuff, and all these other literary critics. At some point people need to use culture to express themselves, and that's why fair use exists. Now, I'm not saying that this particular story, which uses a character and isn't really claiming to do that and isn't really claiming to be some sort of personal expression, definitely is not fair use, you know, or is definitely should be fair use, you know. And I haven't read all the papers and whatnot, so I'm not willing to say that. I'm not surprised, because this was sold as essentially let's just add to the Star Wars canon. We're not really trying to say this is a type of personal expression, right? But you know, when some 15-year-old kid says Star Trek really speaks to me, and I'm gonna create a story in that world, and I'm gonna imagine something that happened in that world as a way to express who I am and what I think of life, you know, that's the kind of expression that we should encourage, right? And you know, the law doesn't always fit the way that people express themselves. In fact, it has never fully, perfectly fit how people express themselves. But that's why copyright keeps being amended over and over and over and over to adjust to technology. It can never quite keep up. But that's the history of copyright, and that's what technology and that's why it's constantly in flux, and that's why it's interesting to folks like me. One other thing really, really quickly is that all of this in the age of the internet, where you can share things easily, in the age of remix, where you can actually create very easily, whether it's your own original content or whether it's by remixing content using, you know, cutting and pasting technology editing technology, you know, the fact is that people can now create in ways they never could before, and that is something that's a glorious blessing for society. And the law is adjusting. It's taking some time, but I think that's the direction that things should go. Now, do I think this prequel, this is sort of faithful prequel that's not by a 15-year-old kid who has really no other means for expressing themselves or doesn't have the vocabulary to do that yet necessarily. You know, obviously this is very, very different. But let's look at fan fiction in the context of our cultural milieu and in the context of the technology that's out there and in the context of what's important to people and what they're talking about and thinking about and how they talk.
I would agree 100% with the policy arguments that you're making and the idea that what it should be. But I just want to highlight from the actual order, you know, when we talked about or when you talked about whether, you know, the idea of Klingons with their bone shaped, you know, bone protrusions could be protectable characters. That's actually what Klausner points out. I'm just going to quote from this. Klingons had distinctive physical features, including ridged foreheads, dark hair and skin, and upward sloping eyebrows. Klingon men also have facial hair. Vulcans are part of a federation, a species that suppresses emotion in favor of logic and reason. They are technologically advanced and frequently have pointed ears and upswept eyebrows with a bowl-shaped haircut. Now, taken together, these characteristics of Klingons and Vulcans are not elements of expression that necessarily follow from the idea behind the expression and may be entitled to copyright protection. So I think that Klausner, it really is implying, I don't disagree with you at all about what it should be, but based on this order, I think that Klausner is implying that the entire Klingon culture, the representation of Klingons, the representation of Vulcans are protectable under copyright, which I agree is very worrisome from a fan fiction and fan art perspective. Because, you know, if we were to take this back and say that, you know, are Tolkien's orcs, you know, are dark, monstrous creatures that are typically, you know, have, you know, oversized muscles and maybe pig-like faces with, you know, large canines and wield maces. I mean, if we were to say that that was a protectable character, then obviously any kind of high fantasy, you know, orc-like character would be infringing. So I think that, yeah, we need to, as a society, get to the point where we recognize the validity of fan art and the importance of remix culture and the importance of the idea that people need to be able to build off of these other works. But that being said, right now, it's a worrisome order, I think.
Yeah, we should point out a couple of things procedurally. Because the judge has decided a bunch of issues here on summary judgment, the next check on that will be after trial, whoever wins or loses. And if Jack's not correct, that it settles. An appellate court would be able to review what Judge Klausner has decided here and decide whether they agree that these findings and determinations were appropriate. So that's where that would get reviewed. I'm wondering, too, procedurally, Jack, what you think will happen. Because the court here has seemingly decided the entire fair use issue as a matter of law before trial, you know, on the evidence before it, based in the context of these summary judgment motions. But you mentioned earlier instructing the jury possibly on the fair use factors. How would that come in?
Well, these things do regularly go I'm having some technical problems here. Things regularly go to the jury, you know, and they're often also, most of the big fair use cases that are out there were not decided by a jury, but there are a number that were. And this very likely could go to the jury. I mean, what he's doing is denying summary judgment. In other words, he's saying, I'm actually don't know whether Judge Klausner is a he or a she, so I should not,
I'm looking.
Make that.
One second. I'll let you know.
Gary Klausner.
Gary.
Anyway,
Gary.
It really bothers me when people default to one or the other. Anyway,
yep.
But the point is that Judge Klausner is simply saying there is not enough here to throw the case out at this juncture. right? So it's likely going to go to the jury. You know, when the juries are given fair use, unfortunately, the four factors of fair use are pretty hard to determine. And if you look at some jury instructions, and this was a really egregious, a really egregious example of this was in the Marvin Gaye case with Robbie, what's his name? You guys know who I'm talking about. In the recent Marvin Gaye case, the Blurred Lines case. You know, if you look at the jury instructions, it's hard for a law student or even a lawyer to understand what they're saying in some of those jury instructions. And the Court of Appeals is probably going to have a field day with that. And this happens often when jury instructions are given fair use instructions. In particular, it's just very, very difficult to determine to make a judgment call on what those factors mean. And there's, you know, reams of law review articles and literature about why the fair use factors don't work very well and fit very well. But it is what it is. So it'll likely go to the jury. Defendants don't have a great time in jury trials about copyrights that involve big franchises, and especially those that involve celebrities. And so that's another reason why I'm hopeful that it'll settle, but I think it should settle because I think, you know, the public should be exposed to this. At the same time, I do think that it's the studio and the creator of a particular work should kind of control how that work is done. And somebody pointed out on the chat, and I think it's absolutely makes a lot of sense. You know, that might conflict with a reboot that they're planning and mess up the canon. I mean, so, you know, if it turns out that Garth of Izar, had a whole double life as a spy, I mean, who knows what, and there's already something in the works on that, you know, 5-10 years down the line that they've spent a lot of money on, they're going to have to rethink all of that. So, you know, I mean, it, you know, there is something to be said for them to control, but at the same time, I think it would be sad for the fans, if they did that, if it were, you know, enjoined and, you know, basically the court, you know, the court has the power under copyright to order the defendants here, Axanar Productions, to simply bury the production. So they can actually seize all the copies of the productions and order them to be destroyed to be destroyed. Now the legal case for that, I think, has to be really, really strong, but you know, that is, you know, something that's in a court's remedy in pretty extreme situations. And it happens more often than you would think. But I also think that, this has been something that, particularly with Star Trek, but also with Star Wars, studios have had to think very, very carefully about, you know, how much do they want to encourage fan fiction and fan art, and how often and how much do they want to control that. And over time, Disney has really evolved into sort of saying, oh, you can't have any fan art, to, you know, encouraging or tolerating a large amount of fan art on sites like DeviantArt. And like, shout out to DeviantArt here, which has been a leader in sort of expressing why fan fiction is important, and why it has a cultural, a very important role in culture. And, you know, I think also a big question to think about is how large copyright owners want to interface and work with their fans. And I think it was with Star Trek, but I may be wrong, so folks, correct me if I am. But I think that with respect to Star Trek, there was actually a stated policy where you could spend up to $50,000 on a fan art production and, you know, go out and do it. And, you know, this received a lot of criticism, and I think there's a Wikipedia article about all the criticism that's pretty informative. But, you know, one big question is, you know, look, you have millions of fans who are absolutely batty over your product, and they want to use that product to express themselves, and they want to add to the corpus with their own fan fiction and their own art and forms of creativity. You know, how do you encourage that while still sort of controlling the work and you know, and while still being able to do what you have the right to do and should have the right to do, you know, and that's a tough line to walk sometimes for these big companies. But I think the smart ones will have a positive relationship with their fans and you know, and say, hey, let's work together to build something together.
Yeah, I think that all of that is completely valid, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, if this case winds up making any law on the fair use front beyond what it's already done. In the order denying the defendant's motion for summary judgment, you know, what they were doing was swinging for the fences, hoping that they could win the case on fair use. That's why they brought their motion. But the court denied that motion. But they also Judge Klausner also found that all four fair use factors weighed in favor of the plaintiffs. Now, I don't know if that means that they're shut out at trial. It kind of sounds like it does. But I guess we'll just have to see what the
I think at the trial they're just going to be ruling on the jury is just going to rule on the substantial similarity. So it is, you know.
So okay, well, okay.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah. Please.
Jack, I was wondering if you could provide a little maybe copyright history lesson for the rest of us. Do you know when derivative works were added to one of the five fundamental rights that copyright protects?
Off the top of my head, I don't, but I think they've been that's been a part of copyright law for many, many decades. So, so I can't say how long, but it would probably go back to before the 1909 Act.
Gotcha. It feels like that is frequently the area where everything sort of breaks down. You know, is both on the fourth factor and on the first factor on, you know, whether or not a derivative work is, you know, good enough, I guess, to detract from the market, or whether or not the derivative, I mean, at least in the fan fiction, in the fan work context, because certainly, you know, the amount of proportion taken, I think, just always weighs against fan fiction under the traditional four-factor analysis because of the derivative work. So I don't know. I've been knocking that around in my head for a while. It feels like we need to – that a lot of fan art would be permitted if copyright just didn't protect derivative works. And it would still protect the ability of the copyright holder to – you know, it would encourage the progress of, you know, the science and useful arts by enabling copyright owners to make money off of their work. But it's not going to protect things that aren't exactly what you copyrighted. But you brought up a great point with, you know, the future canon and the creation of, you know, universes and future marketing possibilities. It's a tough problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, so, you know, derivative works and works that make fair use. So there is some overlap, you know, and so calling something a derivative work doesn't necessarily take it out of the fair use, right? This was an issue, for example, in the Harry Potter case from about six or seven or eight years ago. The court there, this was about the Harry Potter lexicon, essentially sort of an encyclopedia of all things Harry Potter. And this went to trial, and there's a big trial, and it was a trial before the judge, not before a jury. And the judge said ultimately that this was not a derivative work, because obviously it wasn't a sequel. It was a lexicon, so it was like a dictionary, an encyclopedia, and the derivative work was. The court said this violates copyright, but it violates the reproduction right, not the derivative work right. Contrast that with, for example, The Wind Done Gone, which is a parody, or not a parody, it was a commentary on Gone with the Wind. It was sort of Gone with the Wind told from the perspective of an African American. And there the court said that was fair use, even though The Wind Done Gone would clearly be a derivative work if there wasn't fair use. And so, you know, All fair use violates one of the exclusive rights, because it makes copies in form of a quotation or an excerpt or a clip, or it uses copyrightable elements in the form of, you know, if you're doing a parody, for example, you know if you want to do a parody of a Klingon, you're going to show the facial structure and other copyrightable elements of that Klingon, you know. And another, and by the way, you know, if this is also a fun thing to get into, the Klingon, you know, the language Klingon, I don't know if this has been litigated, and so correct me if I'm wrong, but the Klingon language can be taken out of copyright in a sense, and you could say, okay, well, I'm going to actually create sentence talking about, you know, my job or my car or whatever in Klingon, right? And would that be copyrightable? I would argue it probably shouldn't be copyrightable because it's just like a recipe or set of instructions. It's a set of concepts that you're then taking and creating something new with, right? And to me, you know, maybe the bone structure, but like there's a lot of, and this was an issue before the trial, before in motions before the trial as well in this Axanar case, you know, certain elements, you know, a tunic is not copyrightable. The color yellow that Captain Kirk wears is not copyrightable. I mean, you could have trade dress for things like UPS brown, but that's different. You know, there's a lot of elements that aren't a bridge of a ship is not copyrightable. A throne like chair that the captain sits in is not copyrightable. It's when you combine all those things that you get copyright protection, right? And so, you know, with something like Klingon, you could say, okay, well, it's a collection of sounds that you use to express yourself. And I, you know, again, there's a lot of alternate realities or variations on this set of facts where I think it would be a lot more difficult of a question. For example, what if they didn't use any Star Trek characters, but they only use the Star Trek universe? You know, maybe you could say that's a set of building blocks that other people should be allowed to use.
Right. Do you want to bring up for our listeners, the three-factor analysis for copyrightability of a character? That was also a question here as well.
You can go ahead and do it.
So for a copyrighted, I said that as I was furiously searching through the order for the exact quote. But from the, you know, the classic Batmobile case, a character is copyrightable if it is in order for a character to be copyrightable, it has to have its own. It has to be built up way more than just, you know, a stock character, and it has to have its own sort of body of work, and it has to. There's a third one that I'm going to try to find really quickly, listeners. But that being said, you know, that's why, Justice Klausner, Judge Klausner, said that, you know, Garth of Izar is a copyrightable character. He, you know, satisfied all three of those factors. But at the same time, they implied that individual planets, the planet of Axanar, might itself be a copyrightable character. It's that sort of stuff that I'd like to push back against. It seems really worrying and worrisome from a fan art perspective moving forward.
Try to find that. Okay, while you're looking for that, I did want to hone in on the Klingon language issue. There is a motion in limine, and this is not the first time that this issue has come up in the case. We had Mark Randazzo on the show, and he had written this fabulous brief in support of the non-copyrightability of the Klingon language. And it was an amicus brief from an entity called the Language Creation Society that is a very interested party in this case, arguing on the issue of the non-copyrightability of Klingon. I believe that Mark's brief came up in the context of motions to dismiss. Once again, Axanar was trying to make the case go away early, and it did not. Now they've filed a motion in limine in advance of trial, where they're trying to preclude certain items from being capable of being introduced in support of infringement. And one of those things, they argue about costumes and geometric shapes, words and short phrases, and then elements of works derived from nature, the public domain, or third-party works. And the Klingon language, I believe, they argue is not copyrightable, just flat out not copyrightable. The language itself is an idea or system and is not copyrightable. The Supreme Court held in the context of a system of bookkeeping, although copyright protects the author's expression of the system, it does not prevent others from using the system. So that's the one authority they've cited there. Of course, there's a whole brief on this point, a lot of which is in Klingon, that I'm sure they'll hear more about those arguments at trial, should the court be interested in excluding some of these aspects that they've raised here. Do you think they have any luck here, Jack?
On Klingon, I think they have a fighting chance. I mean, I agree that it's a system. I think, you know, again, if you're going to take essentially collections of sounds and turn those into other words, you know, it does sound a lot more like a system than like an individual expression, you know. And you know, again, if you're taking different things and then building them together, now it's I think it's more of a stretch. It's more difficult to say, okay, well, let's take that universe, but not any recognizable characters, and just have, you know, different spaceships and concepts like the Federation or different races, and then create something new out of that, you know. And then you have a question of, okay, well, is the Vulcan a, you know, just a Vulcan itself a character? And I think you'd have a more difficult time there.
Yeah. I do think it'll be fascinating to see how this all goes down. Very excited for the trial of this case to take place, if it, in fact, it does take place. What do you think a settlement would look like if they settled, Jack?
Well, they might say, okay, well, you have to, you know, maybe it would be, well, you know, you have to give us, you know, do this for free, or give us, well, they're already going to do it for free, but, that's a good question. I mean, I think that if there was money at stake and Paramount was okay with it, that might be one thing. But, you know, Paramount's perspective is, hey, you know, if we allow, you know, like really high quality productions to just be put out there, feature length productions, you know, where is that going to end? And, you know, how are we going to be able to control our properties if we're allowing that to happen? At the same time, it seems like a pretty big middle finger to the fans to simply say, yeah, we're not going to stop until Axanar stands down and, you know, buries this and gives this the kibosh, right? And so so maybe Paramount would take it over. Maybe Paramount would say, well, you can only stream this. Maybe Paramount could say, well, you can have a special screening, you know, once. You know, if I were their lawyers, I'd say, let's talk to some charities that we both feel comfortable with, and maybe have some special screens, give the money to charity, and be done with it. I don't know. I mean, you know, if it were me, I would really be thinking about the fans. And this is where, you know, sometimes, you know, protecting your copyright can actually, if you want to take that to the nth degree, I mean, I think copyright gives rights holders so much power that a lot of times what they choose to do is not exercise. In fact, the vast majority of the time, they don't exercise all of the power that they could to control the work, and rightfully so. And so I think, you know, hopefully that's what will end up happening here, just because I think, you know, there's a huge collection of fans that are pretty into this. And, you know, Let's look at the larger context of the Star Trek universe and the Star Trek subculture. I mean, if you look, there's a Wikipedia article about, I was referring to earlier, about Star Trek fan fiction. And I mean, there has been a lot of fan fiction. There have been little mini series. And earlier last year, Paramount actually released some guidelines that said things like, well, you can have up to 15 minutes and so on. And so you can also see this case as a kind of a larger struggle between the fans that want better guidelines and Paramount that wants guidelines that really don't allow the fans to do as much as they like. And that's a struggle that's going to continue regardless of this case. But it's a very interesting thing, because at some point, and I, you know, you got to give Paramount credit. They've already recognized this in their guidelines and stuff, even if it's not satisfactory. And, you know, a lot of people are pretty bitter about it, but, you know, Paramount has already recognized that they're not going to be able to control every expression of this and every piece of fan fiction, and they're not trying to do that, you know. And so somebody wanted to write, you know, a novel length Star Trek spec script, or a novel length Star Trek story, or a spec script, and put it out there, I doubt anything would happen to them given the environment. But I also think, I mean, you can look at Star Wars, you can look at all kinds of stuff where, you know, popular culture becomes people's mode of expression. Now, that may not be as that may not be desirable, and maybe you'd want more, you know, Longfellows or more you know, Hawthorne's or Melville's out there. But, you know, all those people were standing on the shoulders of giants as well, and they were remixing in their own way previous works, as somebody on the chat was saying. And I think that's worth noting as well. I mean, all of copyright, or excuse me, all of culture is derivative in some way. And some things are wildly creative while also being wildly derivative. Harry Potter's a great example. Star Wars is a great example, and Star Trek is probably a great example. You know, those are also really amazing, incredibly creative works. So, you know, they go hand in hand together.
Yeah. So is, you know, the Iliad, the Odyssey. I mean, basically all of the great works of fiction ever is all derivative in some way. Which I think illustrates how problematic current copyright terms are.
Yes, I have here my Live Long and Prosper button. Let me get it in the camera. There we go. That I got as a child, that I'm sure is unauthorized. And, a copyright violation arguably in itself, except for, I believe, speaking of the standing on shoulders of other giants issue, I believe we discussed earlier on the show in a prior episode where the derivation of this hand gesture came from. And it was not Star Trek. It was some other form of greeting or gesture that escapes me right now.
I think it's the sign of one of the old Jewish tribes, and you can actually see it on some old gravestones. And if I can share my screen really quickly, I actually pulled one up, an example that I just did a quick web search. Let me see if I can figure out how to share my screen. Can I do that?
Sure. I don't know if you can share your screen, but if you have a link to something, you could put it in our, I'm not sure where you could put it. You can email it to me.
Wikipedia article in the link.
Yeah, you put it in chat for our Google Doc. I think TD Alex is.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I've got the show.
If you look at, if you Google, live long and prosper sign, grave, you can see screenshots of, let's just do it that way. You can see a number of screenshots of old graves from Jewish cemeteries where people put that sign on there. And I think it's the sign of like one of the
letter
shin.
I guess
it symbolizes
representation of the Hebrew letter shin.
A Hebrew letter. So, there we go. So, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, and let's not mince words. Star Trek is a, incredibly inventive, incredibly valuable franchise that has really touched a lot of people. And the fact that it's that elements derive from other science fiction or other, storytelling legends or tropes or whatever means nothing, it doesn't mean nothing, but you can't take that away from the franchise. I want to give props to the creators of Star Trek and all the people that have worked on it over the years.
Right. Absolutely. Where would we be without Star Trek? Where would we be without documentary film as well? And before we leave the topic of filmmaking in general, I wanted to give a shout out, Jack, because I know this is near and dear to your heart, to the International Documentary Association, and just discuss briefly with you the work that your clinic at UCI, the Intellectual Property Arts and Technology Clinic that you head, has done in the past and continues to do in the way of exemptions from the DMCA for documentary filmmakers and other support of documentary film. You want to touch on those two?
Absolutely. We've worked for quite some time with the International Documentary Association and the National Documentary Filmmaking Community, including a lot of other organizations and hundreds of individual filmmakers, on a variety of issues that are important to documentary filmmakers. One of the biggest ones that we've worked on is getting exemptions to the copyright laws that cover all documentary filmmakers, and we also got one that cover all authors that seek to make to utilize clips from DVDs, Blu-ray, or online media in their films for purposes of criticism and commentary. And the thing is, that use is, unlike the Star Trek case, is a really uncontroversial form of use. It's pretty much a slam dunk fair use and has been for a long time when done appropriately. And the vast majority of documentary filmmakers these days do know how to do it appropriately. The problem is, accessing that material that you want to comment on has gotten more and more difficult because of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And that was passed in 1998. And it basically said, in order to protect against piracy, we want to make it illegal. Congress said, we're going to make it illegal to decrypt from DVDs, Blu-ray, or any protected media that has a password or something like that on it. And so, you know, fast forward, you know, not very long, when VHS goes, you know, the way of the dodo, and now all you have is encrypted DVD, encrypted Blu-ray, and encrypted streams. All of a sudden, you know, let's say I want to do, my favorite example is The Godfather. Let's say I want to do a documentary about the influence of gangster movies on American culture. And it turns out that, as I've heard in real life, no one ever kissed the ring of the Godfather, the head of the family. That was just not a thing. And at the end of The Godfather, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen The Godfather, it's your own fault. Michael becomes the Godfather and they kiss his ring. A very famous scene. Now, I can show that scene. Now, I can't show 15 minutes of it. I can't show the entire final act. That probably would be not appropriate and not fair use. But if I show that scene in a few seconds before and after in order for people to understand the meaning of it, together with my commentary, that would be pretty much a slam dunk fair use. And I'm sure that I believe Paramount, as the owner, would be okay with that and wouldn't make a stink about it. The problem is, okay, I'm making a film. I've got people talking about it. I've got the research and all this, and I've got lots of other films I want to talk about as well. Well, how do I actually access that material and get that into my film in a way that would be acceptable to broadcasters and distributors and theatrical exhibitors? And unless it's archival footage and there's not that much of it, those folks are going to say, this is not, you know, you can't just take a screenshot with your phone and expect us to air that on PBS or HBO or anywhere. And so we went to the Copyright Office, which is part of the Library of Congress, and starting in 2008, and we went back again in 2011 and 12, and then we went back again in 2014 and said, we need an exemption that allows documentary filmmakers to do this. And it was granted. One thing that we've been asking for since 2012 that hasn't been granted is fictional filmmakers, makers of narrative films, are doing the same thing. They're making fair use in a lot of different circumstances, even though it's not a documentary. They're using it not as fan fiction, but as part of the reality that these characters are in. You know, same way that it's legal to show somebody drinking from a can of Coke as long as it's not poisonous or something like that. You know, it's legal also to show someone watching a TV show and then actually having an opinion about that show and commenting on it. And that's a pretty clear form of fair use. There's lots of cases about fair use in fictional works that provides a form of criticism or commentary. But the Copyright Office has so far not granted that. So that's been kind of difficult. But some other areas.
Can we stick on that just for a half second? Because I want to really drive that home to people. I don't think it's entirely clear. You know, what we're saying is that if I'm the movie that comes to mind, I think is Selma, because it was brought up a lot in the comments that I was part of. But, you know, if we're making a biopic about a movie about, you know, a person from history, and in the course of that movie, we want to show people sitting around an old-timey television watching an old piece of, you know, television footage, we could be making, you know, the movie itself can be a valid criticism of the original work. It can absolutely 100% be fair use. Okay, so that means it wouldn't be infringing of anyone's copyright. But at the same time, it's illegal for the filmmaker to actually get the footage that is required to make a fair use. So in a way, it's the DMCA, even though it's purportedly about preventing copyright prevention, copyright infringement, it is admitting that even in cases where there is a fair use, it's still illegal to circumvent the required circumvention in order to make that fair use. So I think that's a subtlety of the argument that is, I hope, made more clear by that, because it's a little insane, I think.
So a really terrific example of this happened in October of 2015. The Steve Jobs film came out, the one with Michael Fassbender. And there were a couple of articles in major trade publications, in The Wrap, which is you know, widely read here in LA, and also I think there was an article in Variety. And essentially, or The Wrap is part of Variety, I don't remember. Anyway, there were two articles, and basically what happened is that they're telling the Steve Jobs story, and they wanted to show the iconic 1984 ad for the Macintosh that was sort of about, it was sort of an Orwellian reality, and all these people were listening to a demagogue speaking to them, and this woman throws a hammer, a huge hammer that shatters the TV screen, and this is like very iconic commercial. What happened was they went to the ad agency. The ad agency, as I understand it, if I'm wrong, I'll post a blog post or something about it. But what I understand happened is that the filmmakers went to the ad agency and said, "Can we use this ad?" The ad agency said, "Well, let's talk to the family." The family said, "No, you can't use it because we don't like what you're doing with this film. We don't like the way you're portraying Steve Jobs. So we want to, you know, make it difficult for you." And this is the problem. This is one of the reasons why fair use exists, because copyright essentially can become a form of private censorship if you don't have fair use. So what happened here in this fictional biopic, fictionalized anyway, they used it anyway under fair use, and they did it appropriately. And you know, this took place only a few weeks before the actual recommendation came from the Copyright Office. And so all of the years worth of sort of quasi-litigation, it was an administrative rulemaking that was run very similar to an adjudication. It was at the very, very tail end of that after everybody had submitted all their evidence and everything. So we wrote a letter, and we basically said, these reports underscore the hollowness of arguments made that question the need for fair use in narrative filmmaking. You know, it's a great example of how, they used it because it would have otherwise been a form of private censorship. If you go to the clinic's website and you click on the work product link, you can find that about halfway down. And it was a fun letter to write, I'm not going to lie.
Perfect. Hey, I'm going to go ahead and put our first MCLE passphrase into this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional who listens to the show for professional credit in your field. There's more information about that at wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there. And if you're a lawyer, we've got a rundown of how to submit for credit in all our 50 jurisdictions. Dictions in the United States. Our first phrase is going to be "give to IDA," the International Documentary. What is that acronym?
Association.
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 Yes. Right. Which you can do by going to Jack's fundraising page. We're going to put that in our discussion points at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're in episode 372 this week. And go ahead and help protect filmmakers and their First Amendment rights by giving to the International Documentary Association through Jack's page. He's raised $161 thus far. I'm thinking that if everyone kicked in a couple bucks who's listening right now, we could bump that up a bit. So good luck, Jack, with that. Also, there were a couple of things I wanted to mention to you as you were speaking. You triggered just a couple of things before we move on, Jack. First is, if you have not seen the episode of Saturday Night Live and the segment in a recent episode with Benedict Cumberbatch, which parodied the Apple commercial, where, you know, the same segment that was at issue that you just described, the 1984 piece from the famous Apple commercial. Benedict Cumberbatch's episode of SNL had a version of that that actually used the Kohler branding, which I found interesting, and it was for the Kohler Cool toilet. where all of the minions in the 1984 kind of universe were sitting on conventional toilets, and Benedict slouches in and parks himself sort of in reverse fashion, looking quite cool on his toilet. So check that one out. It's worth a chuckle and fits in with the universe of here parodying the Apple commercial. And also, I wanted to check with you, Jack, to see if you had seen Rogue One yet, because I think there is some good fodder, again, without giving too many spoilers to people, or really any. I will endeavor not to, but I will just say that storage media play a really interesting role in the film. I think Backchannel or Motherboard had a great article going into very geeky detail on all the storage media in the film. And it occurs to me that perhaps the Rebellion might be your next candidate for the clinic to seek an exemption for, because they access some data, and I think they probably needed to circumvent copy protection to do it. So hopefully the Copyright Office would agree that overthrowing the Empire would be a worthy reason to circumvent protections under the DMCA, mm-hmm. but it's something perhaps for the clinic.
Yeah, that was, we got to give a shout out to the author of that, which was Sarah Jiang, who's really just a brilliant reporter for Motherboard, and mm-hmm. and you know the archive, there are archives all over the country, and the archivist community has been making a lot of jokes about how dumb the archiving practices were of the Empire. You know, like, why are you going to put your archive in a tower that's really prominent, that can be bombed, blow up the whole archive? Why is one very sensible passphrase all you need to get? Essentially, you just need the name of that particular data point, and then you can get it out without a password or other forms of authentication. You know, you only need one person to authenticate it. It goes on and on. Was there not a mirror somewhere? It goes on and on. At the same time, at least they had to travel to the place, you know, as opposed to, you know, a lot of archives or other data repositories, whether they're archived, they could be classified as archives or not, are online and can be hacked. You know, a great example is Chairman Podesta's email, which got hacked. Now, that's not a conventional archive, obviously, like the Empire's and the Star Wars plans. But, you know, look, there are security procedures that, whether you're an archive or your personal archive of your emails or whatever it is, that you should take. You know, the Empire didn't take those, and Chairman Podesta didn't take those, and it's too bad. In the latter case, it's too bad because a lot of private information was made public in a hacking that I think is was really problematic and a terrible stain on our democracy and the way that it was used. That's another story. I am glad that the Empire was sloppy and wasn't thinking about it, and I thank the writers for that.
Right. But do you agree that, I mean, perhaps some copy protection might have been involved that then had to be circumvented? If there's an equivalent of the DMCA Wars universe.
Yeah, you would think that if they have the ability to travel at, you know, beyond light speed and do all kinds of other things and destroy whole planets, that they might have thought about some robust encryption schemes. But
bigly complicated. They're very bigly complicated. This was clearly following recommendations that they use couriers.
Right. Yeah. They just, all business should be conducted via couriers, which, you know, it's interesting because if you read a manifesto by Julian Assange, one thing he said was that, you know, with radical, this is from 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more, I don't know. But one of the things that he has said is that, you know, part of his intention and part of his vision for, you know, his form of radical transparency is to make it difficult for people to do business, particularly people in power. And I guess in this case, he means certain segments of governments or of people that he conceives are in power, make it difficult for them to do business because they have to do everything by courier. And so, you know, Donald Trump, and, you know, just to reference Emery's, just to give some context to Emery's reference, Donald Trump recently said, well, everybody should just, you know, if you don't want something published, you should just do it by courier. At the same time, you know, that's just utterly ridiculous and also utterly hypocritical for someone who's been so opaque about his finances and lots of other things. But aside from the, you know, just absolute ridiculousness and contempt for people's intelligence that displays, that's actually of a piece with what Julius and Assange is on record as wanting, apparently, the Democrats to have to do, which is conduct business, you know, in a way that is extremely inefficient and difficult to do. You know, I think that what instead we should have is really great security training and procedures, robust encryption for anybody that wants to have confidential communications. And I think that, you know, that's not just the Democratic Party and that's not just our intelligence services, but that's also companies that have trade secrets. And there are lots of laws with very sharp teeth that protect trade secrets, right? And we want those laws to actually work, and they won't work if everything can be hacked at all times. And so you know, there's a lot of great engineers and security firms and companies working on this very issue of how to have secure communications and robust communications at multiple levels of society, whether it's a listserv between you and your buddies talking about going fishing, or whether it's, you know, a major party's leadership having high level conversations. These should be protected. I mean, the laws are there. I don't know that the laws need to be much stronger, but the security procedures should be there. And I also think that law enforcement and our intelligence services should be very aggressive in protecting and going after violations and helping people protect themselves.
I totally get where you two are going, but I also understand the desires of those who have fallen in love with the delivery by owl system implemented in the Harry Potter universe, or perhaps just carrier pigeons. You know, it definitely has its charms.
Oh, and by the way, the courier, unless you have a computer that's completely disconnected from the internet on both ends, you know, sending something to a courier is a terrible idea because they can open it up and read it and make a copy, and you don't have control over it, right? Yeah. So really, if you're not hand delivering, sorry, I got off topic and I really want to see this owl selfie, so I'll be quiet now.
that's going to have to wait till the end of the show, unfortunately. Let's move on.
I thought you were getting to the owl selfie.
No, we're teasing it though. Let's talk about Santa. Let's stay on the copyright front, but move away from films. And since the holidays have just concluded, I just loved this story. Mike Keyes is not with us this week. He'll be back next week, but somewhat at his firm had a great post on their blog, and I wanted to take a look at that. This is by Jake Holt at Mike's firm, Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle. I'm not sure if Jake is in Seattle, but in any event, it goes to much of what we've been discussing in the Axanar context. Apparently, there was a bit of a copyright dispute, also a trademark dispute, as the parties vied to decide what form of intellectual property protection they were going to hurl at each other, involving someone who called themselves Fashion Santa. Fashion Santa apparently was very big in Toronto in the holiday season of 2015, and Fashion Santa reminds me a little bit of Doctor Strange. I mean, again, getting back to Benedict Cumberbatch, all roads lead back to Benedict Cumberbatch. He's got a quite a jaunty cape is what reminds me here. Or maybe he just has a jacket tossed over his shoulders in the photo I'm looking at. And he's a former model, a longtime fashion model named Paul Mason, who portrayed this Santa in 2015 at a mall in Toronto. And he's quite dashing. He grew himself quite a lovely white beard. But it's all about the character of Fashion Santa here. What happened was the mall decided decided to employ a different fashion Santa for 2016, which Paul Mason did not like very much. He actually registered a copyright in Canada for a literary work entitled Fashion Santa. And then the mall fired back with trademark applications for the words Fashion Santa, which Paul Mason then attempted to apply for as well. So it's not quite clear what the resolution of all this was, but I thought it was just an interesting example of, once again, parties having created a character that had some value and not being in very good accord about the ownership rights therein. The author here, Jake Holt, concludes his piece: "It's not exactly surprising that Mason saw his creation as a work of art while the mall saw it as a brand, but all this humbug could have been avoided if the parties had negotiated an appropriate agreement before Fashion Santa started posing for selfies with the Biebs." I guess Justin Bieber took a picture with him. "That's why we're asking for better contract terms around IP ownership. We promise we've been very good this year and hardly sued anyone." So just tossing that out to you too, wondering if you found it as sort of delightful and interesting as I did, Jack.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And I just have to say, I'm glad you put a picture of Fashion Santa, because isn't he gorgeous, right? it's really fun. Well, let's go back to, and this is great for the M's. There it is. Love it. Love it. Let's talk about... we're in the Ninth Circuit here physically, but this is the leading circuit on character protection, I would argue, and I know that at least one other circuit, and maybe more, share this this test. So the three-part test is: number one, the character must have generally physical as well as conceptual qualities, right? So it's not just the type of person someone is, but certain physical qualities. Second, character must be sufficiently delineated to be recognizable as the same character whenever it appears. It has to display, and this is a quote, consistent identifiable character traits and attributes, although the character need not have a consistent appearance, right? So a great example is Batman. Batman wears a mask, wears a cape, has bat-like features, usually is all or partly black. Well, that's actually not true, because the Batman TV show, he was mostly blue. But blue or black.
And purple.
Purple is in there. So it doesn't have to be consistent, but it has to be consistent identifiable character traits and attributes. And then third, the character must be especially distinctive and contain some unique elements of expression. Now, this is all taking place in Canada. I can't tell you Canada's test off the top of my head. They may not have one because they don't have as many cases come through their courts as ours. But if we were in California or anywhere on the West Coast, that would be the test. So I put it to you. I mean, do you think that this is a especially distinctive character that contains some unique elements of expression, consistent identifiable character traits and attributes, given the fact that Santa itself is not copyrightable. Santa is, a concept that's been around for many, many years. And if it's not something that's actually in the public domain, then it's it would not be predictable under a doctrine in copyright called Santa Fair, which is sort of basic building blocks of scenes. You know, a drunk with a red nose is a good example of a Santa Fair. So, just a Santa, just a fashionable Santa, I don't think that passes the test very well. You're going to need more and that's only here in the Ninth Circuit and a few other circuits around the country. And I can't say whether that's Canadian law, but that's where I would come out. And, look, mm-hmm. people steal ideas all the time. Sometimes they do so in ways that violate contract. But stealing an idea, unless you're stealing something that's at a treatment script level or that has this really uniquely identifiable expressive characteristics in a character, is not going to be predictable.
You almost said Santa Fair, and I just had to say it for you.
Oh, episode title.
Love it.
Yes. Quite love possibly.
It. Episode title.
Yes.
Yes. Santa Fair is from the French. Yes. It's spelled scenes affair with an old timey E on the end. But Santa Fair is, let's roll with that. Love it.
Yes. Any thoughts, Emery, before we move on?
No, I think Jack nailed it. That was everything I could have said, but, you know, better.
Yeah. The other copyright story I wanted to hit this week was something that Jack noticed over the holidays and posted about, and it caught my eye that way. If it hasn't caught yours, I presume people have heard of Pantsuit Nation at this point. It is at one point, I believe in the process of conceding the election or sometime shortly thereafter, Hillary Clinton referred to secret Facebook groups that she had been part of or had been supporting her. And this is one of them, or perhaps the one of them that was most important in the run-up to the election, where a lot of people expressed their support for her candidacy. And then after the election, lamented her loss and sought solace and support from one another. After the election and over the holidays, it got caught in a bit of flack that I would call copyright flack, because the originator of the Facebook group, in trying to regroup and decide what Pantsuit Nation would do after, you know, going forward, decided that one thing it would do was publish a book, take some of the best material that had been posted there and the most poignant, et cetera, and put it into a book, and went to the community and announced this without announcing really all the details, it sounds like, which is that I don't think it was ever intended as a money-making endeavor, but certain people who had been part of the group went, whoa, wait a minute. And I raise this because it's something that could very readily happen in all manner of contexts where people are participating in online groups, whether they're Facebook groups or, you know, what have you, wherever you've come together to group online and share content. If someone decides they're going to reuse that content, chances are you probably haven't dealt with the licensing issue. The only license I could think of that would be applicable here that was already in place would be the one already in Facebook's terms of service that make all of us grant Facebook a license to republish and use all of our material. So I don't think that the Pantsuit Nation people had a license to use one another's works however they would like.
I think that's actually a point. Yeah. Of course, this prompted me to pull up Facebook's TOS, and I can actually link that in the chat if anyone would like to see it. As you correctly stated, right there in section two, the very first or second line, we all, I think, are aware that anything that we post on Facebook, we give Facebook a license to use however they want. But we also, right there in section two, paragraph four, when you publish content or information using the public setting, it means that you're allowing everyone, including people off of Facebook, to access and use that information and to associate it with you, i.e. your name and profile picture. So I think that that's one of the interesting points here is, the IP ownership of content that's posted to secret groups. Whether, this Pantsuit Nation, which is purportedly a secret, which would imply non-public group that still has 1.8 million members, whether or not that's an actual public submission or would be certainly important in that decision. But also down in section 5.7, the TOS requires that if you collect information from users, you will obtain their consent and make it clear that you, not Facebook, are the one collecting their information, and post a privacy policy explaining what information you collect and how you're using it. So I do think that you absolutely hit on the issue that this is the issue, I think, is twofold. Really, it brings up the point that, in today's click wrap contract controlled world, exactly what is the state of IP ownership and who and when you have granted implied licenses, sometimes very difficult to figure out. And so that's on the IP front issue. And then also, of course, the other side of this is that if any of the Pantsuit Nation folk do want to file a complaint against, what was the woman's name? Libby Chamberlain. The other side of this coin is that they opted into Facebook's TOS, which means that they probably have to go through the mandatory arbitration because this is arising out of those terms.
So let me just point out something that I think is important. If you look at the Statement of Rights and Responsibilities, which is at facebook.com/legal/terms, you look at paragraph two, clause part two, clause one, for content that is owned by, covered by IP rights, like photos and videos, you give us the following permission, subject to your privacy and application settings. You grant us a non-exclusive, transferable, sub-licensable, royalty-free, worldwide license to use any IP content that you post on or in connection with Facebook. Now, when you take your content down, then that license also goes away for that content that you take down.
Right.
But what does use mean? I mean, they say the way that they'll use in other places, they say ways that they will use your information. But if you look down, at clause nine, on advertisement, in order to help us deliver advertising valuable to our users and advertisers, you agree to give us permission to use your name, picture, content, and information in connection with commercial, sponsored, or related content. This means, for example, that we can display your profile picture without any compensation to you. So, you know, you're giving Facebook, and this, you know, can't be, it's hard to overstate this. You're giving Facebook a very wide license to use your content in any way they see fit. It does go away if you leave Facebook for the most part. Although other people's posts,
if other people have shared your work, then that implied license
still
exists.
Stay up.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes. To a degree, but, because if they share a post of yours, sometimes I think that does go away, but that might actually be how it's based on how Facebook's does it as opposed to how, as opposed to what their terms of use say. But just to get back to Pantsuit Nation, that doesn't give the moderator of a secret group or non-secret group the right to use your IP. And so people's posting on Facebook are still Facebook and Instagram can do whatever the heck they want with them, but that doesn't mean that. And I'm hand waving here. So sorry if this comes off as a little ranty. Facebook can do whatever they want, but that doesn't mean that the owner of the group can do whatever she wants and turn those posts into books. So she's
what do you say about paragraph 2, section 4? Clause 4, I think, is pretty clear that it does. As long as this information was submitted via the public setting, it means that everyone can access and use that information and to associate that information with you.
Sure.
It reads to me very broad.
Devil's in the detail with use, though.
Well,
commercial
use? Yeah. To access and use that information. We'd have to look and see how this is getting into the legalese, but this is how lawyers think. Where is information defined, and does information actually include the content? Is it distinct? And we can look at the definitions. Let's see, information, facts, and other information about you, including actions taken by users and non-users interact with Facebook. So they didn't say content; they said information.
Uh-huh.
But of course, the Pantsuit Nation isn't public, even though it's available to hundreds of thousands of people. It's not using the public setting. But just to be clear, and to give the moderator of that group credit, she has stated from the start she's never not had the position that all of the content in that book is going to be with the permission of the people who posted it, and that's not really why people are so up in arms about Pantsuit Nation. It's more because they don't like the direction it's going. And I also, something that we really can't rule out that no one has really talked about in respect to the whole Pantsuit Nation controversy, and that is, a lot of that controversy might be trolls. It might be people that actually want to actively undermine Pantsuit Nation. You know, when you have hundreds of thousands of people in a group, even if they post with moderators, you know, anyone can comment on a post. And a lot of the controversy is taking place in the comments. And that may be people that really just want to undermine Pantsuit Nation and are there for malicious reasons and not because they believe in what that group is about. So let's remember that. And that's part of the new reality this is a new reality of sort of what the world of Trumpism.
A reality of our world right now is that CES is going on even as we speak. So it seems like we can't really do a show while CES is going on in parallel without talking about the Internet of Things and how that is evolving. So let's do a bit of that. So one thing that caught my eye this week is this probably won't be the last time this happens, but it's the first time I've seen so far where law enforcement issued a warrant for Amazon to hand over audio or records from an Echo involved in a murder case, involved in investigating guilt or innocence of the suspect in that case. The Amazon came back to the press and the law enforcement there and said Amazon will not release customer information without a valid and binding legal demand properly served on us. We object to overbroad or otherwise inappropriate demands as a matter of course. Now, if you have a valid and binding legal demand, then presumably you can get at whatever Amazon has. Just caught my eye there. Certainly, lots of people are thinking about Echo Data and privacy advocates warning of surveillance through devices that are listening in one way or another, even if it's just little snippets and not very persistent data. Emery, this is right in your wheelhouse. I just wondered if you, what you thought of the murder case incident and any other developments in this field.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can say anything that I think will come as much of a surprise to anyone. You know, this is obviously what privacy advocates have been warning since the beginning of the IoT and before that. You know, we were saying that with our cell phones that, you know, what we're doing are creating devices that can be used to collect massive amounts of information on us, even, you know, if we're not aware of it. And that information is valuable to people. You know, in this particular one, obviously, you know, Amazon Echo has their Alexa service, which is sort of an always on, always listening. I need to clarify that it's always listening for hot phrases or hot words. I think Alexa is them. So for all of our listeners that have Amazon Echoes in the home, I'm sorry. But it would also trigger for Google Now if you would say, okay, Google. Sorry, listeners. And for Apple, if you would say Siri. And so all of these services
Emery,
that are popping up.
You just turned on thousands of listeners' phones.
Yes, absolutely.
Lit it all up.
Yeah.
Whatever we're saying now, is being uploaded en masse to Apple and Google servers.
Absolutely. And so that's the point.
Don't
you know,
be when evil, these Apple. Don't be evil, Apple. Don't be evil, Google. Stop it.
There, I just... okay, Alexa, how do I get blood out of a blanket? Sorry for everyone. So, I mean, the point is that, yeah, you know, this information is valuable and, you know, privacy advocates have warned
before.
I've been on lists. But, you know, privacy advocates have warned that, you know, for one of the problems with these devices are that, you know, the hot phrases may trigger accidentally. The other problem is obviously it's not exactly very clear to users, I think, almost universally. You know, the specific terms of how this information is stored, how long is it stored? Is there any way of deleting these utterances? Are they automatically deleted eventually? For example, if you use OK Google, I think that a lot of our listeners might be surprised to find that Google has a page that you as the user can go to that will have every single OK Google recording that you've ever asked, that you can just press a play button and listen to it. And you'll be like, oh, wow, yeah, that was me asking for directions to the, you know, the bar at 3 a.m. And so that alone is its own sort of nest of privacy issues. Again, it harkens back to the Samsung TV from a few years ago. Sorry, the other privacy side of this is that sometimes companies, you know, what they're saying are the best practices that they're employing for this information is not necessarily what they're actually doing. We can remember the Samsung TV case that was discovered, I think, 2 or 3 years ago to have been sending, you know, full-on recordings and transcripts of the recordings of everything to Samsung for the purpose of making it easier for you to change the channel on your TV by shouting at it. You know, there's a lot. I think the fundamental problem comes down to user expectations and disclosures. You know, are users aware of exactly how these devices are listening and what information they're getting? But to be honest, in this particular case, that is the other. That's the least interesting part of it because, to be honest, that's been talked to death about before. I think that the idea that police would be coming for Amazon Echo data was not a matter of, you know, if or as much as it was when that would happen.
Right.
No one's surprised that was going to happen. What interests me about this case, though, is that suspect was an IoT aficionado. He not only did he have Alexa, but he also had a smart water meter in his home. And the police were able to get data from the smart water meter that indicated that he flushed 140 gallons of water in his bathroom that day. Side of it is way more interesting from the perspective of IoT in a larger context than the Alexa hot phrases, because the other thing to remember is that we're having all of these utility, all of these, whether it's your Hue light bulbs or your smart water meter or your refrigerator or your toaster or whatever, that are also going to be collecting information about your use and about when and how you use it, that is going to be valuable for hackers and for, law enforcement agencies. The LEOs were able to say, look, this guy flushed 140 gallons of water down his shower. We think this was probably used to clean things. And that if people were more aware of that, literally all of these devices and all of the information that they collect can help create a more full picture, a more complete picture of your activity, and that information is valuable, I think that we would all, have a great service. So
that is really fascinating, Emery, and a great thing for people to bear in mind, especially if they have.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out.
Go ahead.
I just want to give a shout out to my colleagues back at Berkeley. We wrote a paper about this back in 2005 with Galen Hancock, Deirdre Mulligan, and others, talking about the privacy implications of smart meters and demand response electricity metering. And this is a real issue when you have sensors in every room. You can tell how late someone's staying up. You can tell whether they're home.
Add health and fitness trackers to that. Once you start collecting biometrics information as well, your Fitbit can tell, hey man, this guy's heart rate was elevated to a really high degree right after he flushed 140 gallons of water down his toilet. And, the lights came on in his garage and then turned off and came on like 7 times, all of these things are valuable.
Right. I got this great Fitbit from my wife and I was super excited to monitor my sleep. And then I realized the only way I could actually check my sleep numbers was by uploading all that information to Fitbit.com. I was like, why do I have to upload it to Fitbit.com just to get it off my phone? But it won't sync without internet connectivity and uploading. And frankly, I don't feel comfortable giving all that information to a company, actually there was a story early on in Fitbit where it actually was making some of that information public. And, if you can tell from heart rate information and activity pretty easily when somebody's working out and when they're having sex. And, don't wear your Fitbit in the bedroom maybe, but, either way, it's just super creepy. And the problem is that people are not well informed about this. People don't have proper notice of what they're actually giving away and how it's being used. And the long terms of service that, that you agree to when you upload that Fitbit and log in, just don't provide adequate notice. And when all the providers do it and there's only 5 or 6 or 8 providers and they all do it, the free market isn't working very well. If consumers say, I really want to do this, but I absolutely have no choice to use any of these things unless I give my information to these companies, that's market failure.
Yeah.
Some of it could be just the shift into a generation of people who don't give a darn about sharing that. I didn't have a fitness tracker at the time.
I was going to say
a pre-fitness tracker. I was using a weight monitoring app that was available through the Apple Store, and you were supposed to, like you do with many fitness trackers, if it can't keep track of what you're eating, so you're supposed to put it in. It can't keep track of every single thing you're doing, so you're supposed to put it in. Here, it just sort of skipped the tracker, and you were putting all that data into the app. And one of the things it just had as a menu item was when you were having sex, and how often, and for how long. just expected people to put that in, and I'm sure lots of people did without batting an eye.
You know, there, just to give another shout out to my former institution, Berkeley.
Yeah.
They've actually done a lot of research going back over 10 years, showing that people really actually do care about their privacy. The whole thing about people don't care about their privacy anymore, that's a myth. That's also known in my household, we call it the Mark Zuckerberg gaslight, or the Eric Schmidt gaslight, because they're saying, oh, you don't care about privacy because I'm using my market power and the network effects of this social network, which, to be honest, gives a lot of great benefits, and let's acknowledge those. But still, we're using this to foist a lot of violations of your privacy on you that you're not informed about and don't have a choice about. And that's very different from people saying, oh, I just don't care about privacy anymore. And, you know, where does that end? Does that end with all of our email being hacked and all of our information being made public for the press to sift through, or for people that don't like what we're saying to sift through? I would say nobody wants that. So where does the gaslighting end?
Well, here's part of it ends. Maybe part of it ends with white hat ransomware. Can we talk about a crime and justice story here at the end of the show before we wrap things up? I never thought I would be pondering whether ransomware could be white hat, but now I am, thanks to Kulova, which is something I spotted courtesy of Emery, who was very interested in it, and another ransomware story that was far from white hat a little earlier on, called Popcorn Time. Why don't you describe both of them to us, Emery?
Sure. So I'd like to start off with the Popcorn Time ransomware. So our good friend Steve Gibson over on Security Now had an episode where he talked about this on Security Now, episode 590. If you would like to go listen to a more technical breakdown of it, I highly recommend it. So this was the coolest, scariest thing I heard the entire time I was off the air last month in December. Popcorn Time is a piece of ransomware that was discovered that is fascinating. So ransomware was the scourge of 2016 and 2015, and continues to be a huge threat in this year as well. Effectively, it is malware that encrypts the contents of your computer and then requires or presents a message to the user that says, hey, if you ever want your files back, pay us, you know, X amount of bitcoins, and we will send you the decryption key to decrypt your files. And this is really novel and interesting for a lot of ways. One of the reasons I think it's interesting in particular is the fact that for the first time, you know, paying a ransom is guaranteed to get you the stuff back. And so it's been enormously successful in that regard. So last month, a piece of ransomware was discovered in the wild called Popcorn Time, not to be confused with the Netflix meets Torrents open source software that we talked about last year of the same name. This piece of malware of ransomware infected your system, encrypted your files, and then presented you with a message that said, you know, as expected, if you'd like to see your files again, you can pay us one Bitcoin. It also gave a second option for decryption, and that's where it gets utterly fascinating. The second option for decryption was, look, we understand $780, that's what a Bitcoin was at the time, is a lot of money. There's a nastier way of getting your files back, and they actually use the term, the nasty way, and that is, you can send this link to multiple people, and if two or more people follow this link, install the ransomware themselves, we will know that, and we will then send you a decryption key.
Oh, that is the most evil thing. Yeah, most evil thing I've ever heard.
So it's leveraging the fact that ransomware is enormously successful because it works and it does exactly what it promises. It then solicits users to, you know, get in on their conspiracy and send out that message to other users and to spread the infection. I predict that this will be enormously effective as well and very, very evil. Another aside to the whole Popcorn Time ransomware that made it a little interesting is the fact that the message that was presented to users said that the creators of the ransomware are Syrian refugees, or not refugees, they're Syrian computer science students, and that the quote-unquote proceeds from this ransomware attack would be used to provide shelter and food to those in need. And, you know, I quote, you know, we're really sorry that we have to that we have to get you to pay this, but it's the only way for us to survive. So So,
have you fake newsed that last part or no?
No, that is that's a screenshot from the actual the message that appears on it. If you look in the show notes from Steve Gibson's from Security Now's episode, they have an actual screenshot of what's presented. And on the left is, you know, the normal way, the nice way. On the right, it says the nasty way. And then underneath it in a little green box, it says that, we're a couple computer science students. I lost my family and my little sister earlier this month. Siri's in a lot of trouble. And this is the only way that we can get you to pay stuff. So,
yes. So that's what they
said. So that's a whole nest of really fascinating, terrifying issues, right?
This week, we have another article from Bleeping Computer that says this Kuvlova ransomware does something a little different. So this piece of ransomware infects your computer, encrypts your stuff, presents a message that says that if you'd like to get your data back, you've been infected with ransomware. What you need to do is you need to read two articles about how to avoid ransomware. And they will then send you the decryption key that will decrypt your files. And so in a way, this reminds me of the computer worm from, I want to say, 4 or 5 years ago that made waves by infecting routers that had known vulnerabilities.
Yes.
And it would infect and spread itself through routers with known vulnerabilities. And then all it did, it didn't steal any information. It just infected itself and then spread. But before it left, it would close off the known vulnerabilities that the manufacturer had left in place. It's what we're seeing is this sort of bizarre, I'm not going to call it white hat by any means, but it's nothing we've ever seen before. And it's very, very weird. And so, when I'm thinking about these two articles together, the idea of like white hack ransomware or activist ransomware, what is there ransomware that can be spread by, if you want to decrypt your files, show us, or send a Bitcoin to this charity.
Fundraising slash terrorism. Educational ransomware.
When we're talking about cyber warfare and, the effect of, when terrorism was originally, created as a way of enacting, international dialogue and, political change and military change, it was a way of recognizing that this thing works, it is evil, and it gets right to the heartstrings of the people that are concerned about this and paying attention to it. Man, ransomware works. It works really well at getting people to do what they want you to do. And it is fascinating and terrifying to see how this stuff is changing. This totally blew my mind out of my face onto the screen. I had to wipe. It was, I've been thinking about this a lot.
It's a messy image. Still a crime, though. No matter what higher motives may be involved in the ransomware. Ransomware is still a crime, at least in the United States, and I assume elsewhere. Jack, anything to add?
Well, I'm super terrified right now. it's really I haven't looked very much into this, but it's very strange to me because why would you break so many laws? I mean, does a ransomware, when you download it, do you agree to terms of use that says we're going to lock this up? And, I wouldn't think you would. So I don't really see the motive for doing this. And I'm wondering if perhaps the motive is actually that there is malware on there that stays on your computer. And somehow, your data is unlocked for you, but there's also trackers or something on there. I really don't know. But
You realize what you just came up with, though. You came up with the quote unquote white hat ransomware to educate people about what's hiding in terms of use. Because if they did have to actually do a legally enforceable click through agreement.
Actually, there's a great company. There's a great movie called Terms and Conditions May Apply about this issue. And a video game company out of the UK actually did that. And they said that if you click on this, you give us your soul for all eternity. And I think like 13,000 people clicked on it over a few days. Yeah. And then they said, big joke. And then, I don't know what they did with all those souls, it's not quite the same, but they did, there have been some stunts like that are pretty funny.
Right.
So I am not a criminal law. You know, my criminal law is very, very rough here. And I know that we don't have any criminal law attorneys on the show today. But my question, you know, when I saw this, the popcorn time, I immediately did think of rap contracts. And, you know, whether this was, you know, is that a contract that you're getting into? Is that a terms of service for, you know? And also, you know, is that a conspiracy then if you are agreeing to it? You know, where does the solicitation end, the conspiracy begin? And obviously, yeah, so it's a crazy world out there, guys.
It is.
It's
it
pretty
is.
Wild, isn't it?
Thanks for flagging those for us, Emery. Let us conclude the show as we often do with our animal selfie of the week.
Finally.
Sorry to make you wait so long. I know it's been a long haul, but at least now we know that this particular animal selfie of the week, aside from being dramatic and gorgeous, could be useful in transmitting information back and forth. Let's just enjoy the fact that I believe this was in the UK. That's actually somewhere snowy.
Quebec.
That's in keeping with our season here. Oh, it's Quebec. Yes. A snowy owl was caught by a Montreal traffic camera, both in fast and slow motion there for you and in all of its lovely dramatic flight. And goodness knows, you know, what bit of information it was carrying from point A to point B. But let's hope it reached its destination. Our tip of the week for you this week is a great tip that also goes to much of what we've been speaking about today on the show. A piece at Consumerist called "Did You Get a Gadget for Christmas? It's Time to Opt Out of Mandatory Arbitration" by Laura Northrup. Consumerist is on this issue very frequently. We've flagged other articles they've posted on this topic on the show. They rightly point out that whatever you may have received for the holidays, whether it is a smart home device or a Fitbit or whatever, somewhere that device is going to have a EULA or terms of service, that whether it's going to be online or in the app that's associated with the device. We encourage you to seek them out and see if there is an arbitration clause. And if there is, there may be the ability to opt out of mandatory binding arbitration. Usually all you have to do is just send a quick email to the company, let them know, I decline to participate in mandatory arbitration, and I'm sending this email per your terms. That will enable you to have a trial if you would like one. Otherwise, you don't have the option. As they write at Consumerist, if you choose to use arbitration, that's fine, but it should be your right to choose the venue that you prefer if you ever have a dispute with a company that made your product or the software that runs it. So don't neglect opting out of mandatory arbitration. And now would be a really good time if you have new gadgets in your life to consider that you might need to do that. Our resource of the week is pretty cool, from a derivative work, fair use remix standpoint. It is a visualization of every line from the Hamilton musical, and it draws relationships. It's by Shirley Wu. It's from Polygraph, or it's using Polygraph, I think maybe the right way to say that, which is a visualization tool. And it allows you to see every line in the musical and see the context, the order, and who it was directed toward. Shirley Wu went through every single line in Hamilton twice and recorded who sang each line as well as who that line may have been directed towards. She's noted every phrase that was sung more than once across more than one song, and that happens a lot in this show, and grouped them into broad themes so you can watch how those develop. Very interesting project from Shirley. And also interesting is the fact that the Hamilton, the musical, tweeted out this resource on its own Facebook page with the caption, every action is an act of creation. So there's an example of someone embracing and then hashtag rise up. So embracing the mashup and promoting it actually by the rights holder. So kind of a neat resource there. And then I think we do need another passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law before we go ahead and wrap it up. Let's make it rise up from Hamilton. And again, we put two of these in each show in case you need to demonstrate to your oversight board that you actually watched or listened. So those are our phrases for today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Week in Law. I've had so much fun chatting with you, Jack and Emery. Jack, anything going on at UCI that you want to let people know about? Anything current with the clinic before we go ahead and wrap the show?
No events or anything like that that I can mention. This past year was a really successful one for the UCI Intellectual Property Arts and Technology Clinic. Among other things, we welcomed Christina Gagne as an adjunct professor, and she's heading up a small tech startup practice, pro bono tech startup practice for our clients. So if you want to learn more about the clinic, awesome. You can go to ipat.law.uci.edu. Thanks for having me on, Denise and Emery. This was a lot of fun, and hope to see you guys again soon.
That's a great resource too. I know tons of people who would love to take advantage of a pro bono tech startup practice.
We also work with, area. We do a lot yeah. of work as well with documentary filmmakers, as well as nonprofits on IP and tech policy issues.
Right. Wonderful. Cool. Thank you so much, Jack. Great chatting with you. Emery, good to have you back.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be back. And yeah, it sounds like Jack's workshop follows a lot of the same stuff that New Media Rights does. So I'm going to give a shout out to them because you can never, give too many shout outs to organizations that need it. New Media Rights does a lot of the same stuff. If you're down here in Southern California and San Diego, I highly recommend checking them out. Maybe donate to them whenever our fundraiser comes up. It's been a great episode. Thanks so much for having me. And Jack, it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you again.
It's been so great chatting with you both and having all of you in our audience join us. If you have joined us live, that means you tuned in hopefully right around 11 o'clock on this Friday afternoon. That's when we record the show, 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC. Might be 1800 UTC this time of year, I think, with the time change. I think that's right now. Anyway, that's when we do the show. And we love it when you can join us live, jump into IRC, let us know what's on your mind as we're doing the show. If you can't do that, though, don't worry about it. Head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive of shows is there, going back 10-plus years now. So, if you feel like a little binge twill watching, that's the place to go. Also, we're available on YouTube. We're available on Roku. In fact, if you go to the twit.tv/twill page, there will be all kinds of suggestions of ways you can enjoy the show, this and all the rest of the Twit shows, at your leisure on whatever device in whatever locale works best for you. So we're just thrilled that you join us. However, whenever you do so, please do get in touch with us between the shows. Emery is Emery at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike Keys is Mike at twit.tv. Let us know what's on your mind, what you'd like to hear more of, what follow-up comments you have regarding things that we've already discussed, what guests you'd like to suggest we invite on the show. All of those things are super helpful. And just, jokes, movie recommendations. I get all kinds of great stuff from our listeners. So thank you so much for continuing to keep those things coming. We very much appreciate you. We appreciate being here for our first show of 2017. We'll have many more to come. And the next one will be next week. So we'll see you then on This Week in Law. Take care.